Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to keep looking through those cultures of consciousness. And today, we're going to cast our gaze forward into the future. Our guest today is Ramez. I always know him as Mez, so I'm going to call him Mez. Old friend of mine, Ramez Neeman, his new book, Nexus. And we've had Mez on the show before. Long-standing listeners may recall a conversation we had a number of years ago about his first book, a nonfiction book, More Than Human, which was looking at the real possibilities of human transformation, particularly through neural technological interfaces, the exciting and to many people dizzying and even deeply disturbing possibilities that makes. Mez is a great proponent of an optimistic view of these possibilities. And so we talked a lot about the dark side and the light side and how to think about the, you know, real likelihood that our fundamental sense of what it means to be human and our ability to amplify and modify our humanity through technological devices, through drugs, through mind technologies is really going to, and is in fact already shaking up our sense of who we are and forcing even people who don't really care about philosophy to ask somewhat philosophical questions. And wonderfully, Mez has made this move of moving to fiction and putting a lot of effort into writing a very compelling, juicy, fun techno-thriller, futuristic techno-thriller sci-fi book that also plunges into some of the same kinds of questions, but from some different angles. So I'm really psyched to have him on the show and to talk about his new book, Nexus, which I think is doing pretty well. But before we get on to that, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
How's it going? We haven't done this for a couple of weeks together.
I know. It's so nice to hear your voice.
Yeah. No, it's good. It's good. You know, I suspect that you have some trepidation about transhuman or even posthuman technologies, but I'm wondering if there's one thing that you've kind of thought about that, you know, God, it would be really nice to, I don't know, have a memory chip implanted that would, you know, change the way that I remember, or foreign language devices, or pull down menus at the side of your eyeballs. There's got to be something that tantalizes you in particular.
Right. Well, you know, I've thought about it a lot for a long time. I remember I was in high school, and I was 16 when I first read Eric Drexler's book, The Engines of Creation. I got
it from
a super nerd friend of mine in high school that also was responsible for giving me Noam Chomsky books, too, this guy named John Pierce. And so I, at that moment, you know, and I've always been really into sci-fi, and so, like, Johnny Mnemonic was something like I thought about a lot. I was like, yeah, that's totally going to happen. So in imagining that future where there could be, you know, these kind of like little additions to our brain where we could do extra stuff. I mean, as a mom, I've noticed, and I don't know how many people that are parents do this, stuff just gets lost in there, man. I mean, I was pretty good at keeping on top of everything, and my memory is pretty crazy. Like, I have a photographic memory. I usually do pretty good, but there are things that slip out. So the idea of having, like, one of those memory enhancements is a little tempting, but generally, as you suspect, the whole idea of just even having anything like that in my brain kind of gives me hives a little bit.
Well, that's good. I mean, I think it's a rich place to go back and forth and to be someone who's both attracted to and concerned about this stuff, or even, you know, kind of imaginatively thrilled by it, even as you can see these possibilities. It's a great place to turn to Mez and talk about Nexus. Well, thanks for being on the show, Mez.
Thanks for having me, Maja.
Hi, nice to meet you.
So great. So hey, congratulations on the book. It's doing really well. That must
Thank
be satisfying.
Thank you so much. Yes, very satisfying.
I mean, this is kind of an obvious question, but a place to start is, you know, you put out your previous book, and I knew you were going to write another one, and I expected you to keep on the sort of former technologist, futurist, conference speaker, talking head kind of routes with these ideas about transhuman technologies. And, you have your background. You were at Microsoft for a long time. You know the technology world. You know the world of TED Talks and all that kind of stuff. And that's sort of what I guessed was going to be happening. But you decided to write a science fiction book. Not that they're mutually exclusive, but still, there's a lot of work, a lot of different kind of skill sets to learn, a different audience. What was it that made you want to write a fiction?
Well, to be honest, it started as a lark. I just started writing something with some friends, and I had a little amateur writers club. I never really thought it'd get published, and then it turned from a short story into something longer, and then turned into a book. And I was at a point where I was kind of stalled in writing a different nonfiction book. And it turned out I had something on my hands that looked pretty good. So from there, I just kind of took it and ran with it.
That's great. Well, I mean, it's really interesting to read because, I mean, I want to let you describe a little bit about the book and the plot, the setup, because you'll do a better job than I did. But reading through it, one of the things that I really thought about was how you end up dealing with similar problems that you deal with when with your nonfiction hat on, in terms of understanding the science, projecting some of the technologies, projecting some of the social consequences, some of the fears, and some of the decisions that we will have to make as individuals, as societies, as we face these things. But doing it in a fictional context is a really different way of approaching these questions that are still really significant. So for me, it was a really wonderful read for that level, as well as just being a fun book. But I don't want to launch right into that, so why don't we first just let people know a little bit about what the story and setup is.
Sure. It's a near-future sci-fi thriller. It's a little cyberpunky. The year is 2040. Our protagonist is a grad student in San Francisco, and he and his friends are hacking on something called Nexus. And Nexus is a drug that's come onto the market, street drug, but it's a nanotechnologically based drug. So you swallow it, it gets into your brain, connects to your neurons, and if somebody with you has swallowed some too, then those nanobots attached to your brains start bridging you wirelessly back and forth. So you get kind of almost telepathic. You can feel what they're feeling, think what they're thinking to a limited extent. And so my protagonist and his buddies are working on expanding the capabilities here, making it better, making the range longer, building apps that run on top of it, that sort of thing. And this is highly illegal. It's a world that has been scarred by abuses of biotechnology and nanotechnology and neurotechnology, mind control, and all sorts of bad things have happened. And so they're busted, and he's blackmailed into going to an international neuroscience conference, which doesn't sound like the most exciting setting, but it really is, actually. So he goes up to Thailand, and he's being used, he's being blackmailed into being a double agent for the U.S. to try to entrap a Chinese scientist. And then from there, bullets start flying, Buddhist monks start turning up, things go a little crazy, and our protagonist is definitely in way over his head.
Yes, that was marvelous. Thank you so much for that. Okay. It was definitely better done than I would have guessed. But why don't we first talk a little bit about how you created the idea of this technology. I mean, it sounds kind of, you describe that, I'm like, oh yeah, science fiction, great, whatever. But you, both from your background and from with your intention with the book, is to really try to, stay pretty close to science to scientific possibility while, you know, allowing yourself to, you know, fabulate some. So what are some of the science behind the drug nexus and the idea of kind of building brain mind-to-mind interfaces through technology and through drugs?
Right, yeah, I did try to stay as close to the science as I could, and that science actually is part of what got me to write my first book, More Than Human. The first thing that really triggered that book idea, and which in a way led to this book, was this paper that I read, a scientific paper, where they had taken a rat and put electrodes in its brain, in the part of its brain, the motor cortex, responsible for using it, moving its paw, and they had trained it to, just by thinking, control a robot arm that would deliver water to its cage. So the rat would, like, think about it, the little computer would try to figure out what neurons were firing, and they would figure out the pattern that it used, and it would adapt its pattern to them. And from there, things have just gone on, the field has exploded. So now we have brain implants to give people control over robot arms for paralyzed people. We have brain implants that are piping video straight into the brain to restore vision for blind people. The cochlear implant has been there for a long time. It's an implant that attaches to the auditory nerve and takes audio that it picks up and translates it straight in the nerve impulses that go into the brain. We have experiments where they can put people in an MRI machine, an fMRI, a brain scanner, show them a video, and the fMRI, just by looking at what's happening in their brain, can reconstruct what they're seeing. Not very well, but sort of. So all of that stuff that's really happening, it's happening for medical reasons. Tell people that are paralyzed or blind or deaf or have some brain damage from a traumatic injury. But that's what I try to extrapolate out into the future and had a lot of fun doing so.
Yeah, that sounds good. You know, it's funny, one of the things that I was thinking about with, this comes up a lot when one talks about transhuman technologies or potentials, is that, all the research, or the vast majority of the research, is being done for medical reasons, for people who want to get back up to the level of what we would think of as normal human capacity, because they're blind or they have physical degeneration. But there's no way to extricate that process from enhancement and from the building tools and technologies that are going to allow people who are already quote unquote normal to really jump much further into it. And it's a really very intriguing kind of, not really a paradox, but just sort of you can't get one without the other, and it's something that I think you play with a bunch in the fiction. It's just the way that you can't extricate the sort of easy to assimilate aspects of these technologies without having to wrestle with some things that are much more challenging, potentially much more exhilarating in some ways, but also things that really raise some pretty heavy questions. And it's funny too, because then this is the kind of question I have for you, is that it sometimes seems to me, when I've gone to talks and conferences and read texts that come out of this, is that the people who are interested in it are really interested in it for enhancement in a lot of ways. They're really interested in, like, hey, we can actually make things better, this could be really great, there's all sorts of reasons for it, but the way to get the funding and the way to make people feel better about it is to do it through the medical discourse, that this will enable us to deal with, you know, people who are paraplegic or this and that. And it's a kind of funny thing, because it reminds me of it's not unlike some of the discourse around medical marijuana, where a lot of the people who are interested in that fight really just think that human beings should be able to use marijuana when they want to for their own purposes, for healing as well as recreation as well as cognitive enhancement even. But what you got to put out there, kind of this medical argument, and that's sort of how you kind of get in the back door. I'm curious if you feel that's kind of one of the things that's going on inside the sort of world of people investigating and researching these transhuman technologies.
Well, I think that's an awesome insight, actually. Like, the opponents of medical marijuana said, hey, these medical marijuana initiatives are really a slippery slope to just legalization of marijuana for recreational purposes or whatever you want to do. And, of course, all of us who wanted the initiative to pass said, oh, no, that's not what it's about. But, of course, it was what it was about, to be totally honest. And we see that now. You know, my state, Washington State, passed a complete decriminalization of marijuana. And I'm sure it was partially a result of the medical marijuana initiatives kind of getting people ready. In the brain-computer interfaces area, I definitely see both. You know, everyone is very aware that there's huge clinical need. You know, there's potentially millions of people, actually. If you look at all the people who are blinded in various ways, who Parkinson's is an area that seems to be working out, all the people who use cochlear implants, all the people with damage to their memory from some blow to the head or some fall from a ladder, there's a very, very large population that can benefit from this, and that is a real motivator. But scientists are also innately curious. And so the scientists that are working on this, they're not at all blind to the enhancement possibilities, and I think it excites them. I'm not sure if that's their primary motivator, or even if it is in the long run, they have to kind of sublimate that and focus on the reality of what they're doing now, which is primarily clinical, helping people who have suffered some sort of damage. But there are some areas of research that aren't just entirely about that. And interestingly enough, and this sort of ties back to the book in a certain way, one of the funders of research here, even though the things they fund have a direct military bent, is DARPA, you know, who funds advanced research activities for the Department of Defense. So DARPA has spent tens of millions of dollars in grants to researchers working on brain-computer interfaces, both because it's interested in medical technology that could help soldiers that have been injured in wartime, but also because it's interested in enhancement. One particular initiative DARPA has is called the Advanced Battlefield Communication Program, and that has funded grants to researchers that have done work on linking minds in animals. So I'll tell you about one study in particular that is kind of, you can see it clearly leading to the world of Nexus, to this technology that links brains. So these guys, Thomas Deadweiler is one of these researchers, he's at Wake Forest University. They got a grant from DARPA, from DARPA's Advanced Battlefield Communications Program, to do this study. They took two monkeys, rhesus monkeys, put them in different rooms with soundproofing between them. Each monkey had an implant in part of its brain, the auditory cortex, the part of the brain responsible for processing hearing. They both had those implants. Those implants were both wired to a computer and not connected the two of them together. Okay? They put them in different rooms. They play a noise for one monkey, and what they want to see is, can the second monkey that's not in the same room but has a brain linked to the first one hear the noise and identify it? And they can. They can have one monkey hear the noise and another monkey that's only linked by this brain connection know what's being heard in the other room. And so DARPA sees that as a very small stepping stone to soldiers innately knowing what the rest of their squad is doing or innately understanding the feed from the drones around them or what command wants them to do.
That's remarkable. So it's really, and one of the things that I've been thinking about, and this I had mentioned before, about what I really liked about your novel is, because it's a novel, and you want it to be thrilling, and you want there to be, you know, global politics, violence, vile underground characters, sex, you know, that's all stuff that we want out of a popular fiction to make it entertaining, to make it resonate, you know, to give it drive. But what that sort of did is encourage you to look even more closely at some of the really scary possibilities of these things. And so, like, just to go with the kind of core idea of a technology of mind connection, of some kind of mind meld, obviously from the book, you're influenced and inspired, and we'll talk more about this, by both the sort of culture of psychedelics and MDMA and the possibility of these things being bringing people closer together, creating empathy, creating, at the very least, a lot of fun, but also a sort of way of communing with people that can be very healing. And at the same time, you're like, well, but there are, you know, sex slaves, and there are military uses for this, and there's ultimately coercion, you know, sort of the puppeting of bodies other people's bodies by military forces in order to make them do things that they wouldn't otherwise choose to do. So I'm kind of curious for you, as somebody who's already been in the role of a cautious but optimistic in many ways supporter of transhuman technology and really engaging with these issues, how was it to start to think about some of these more graphic challenges?
Well, it was super fun, and I think it made it a better book. I mean, you asked about the difference between fiction and nonfiction, and I think in a lot of ways, fiction is just more powerful in being able to grasp people. It can grasp people emotionally in a way that nonfiction kind of seldom does. Occasionally, the very best does. And one of the things that I decided early on in writing the book was that I didn't want it to be one-sided. You know, I have an opinion on what the right path is here, but I only felt that I had credibility in expressing that opinion to some extent by showing all sides of the debate and by showing many bad things and many good things. Being an optimist about technology does not mean that you think there will be no problems. It means that you think that on balance, the good outweighs the bad. But you can't find any technology that's ever been developed that hasn't had some negative effects, too. Right? It's just that we try to maximize the positive ones, and we put rules around the negative ones. Even psychedelics or, let's say, drugs in general, positive effects, negative effects. Airplanes, lots of positive effects. They're also used to drop bombs. Antibiotics, lots of positive effects, and you can certainly think of some negative ones with antibiotic resistance and overpopulation and so on. Agriculture, I mean, whatever you want to name. There's been good things, there have been bad things. And you can look at the world, as I do, and say, hey, overall, things are much better than they've ever been, and that's in large part because we've embraced technology. That doesn't mean that we haven't introduced new problems. And so right. I really wanted to show that just to be fair, and I think it made it a much better book along the way.
Yeah.
Well, it's true. I mean, that's an important point that you bring up, and I think a lot of people, when thinking about introducing drugs or technologies into their body, I mean, they forget about this long history of enhancement that we already do, especially in biological ways with things like antibiotics, or you can look at probiotics. I mean, how many organisms do we introduce into our bodies for enhancement? You know, like vaccinations are a totally good example of that, too. So when people get, like, all freaked out about that kind of thing, you have to realize, like you said, in our culture today, how many of those things are already extant. And then considering, like, well, what's the worst possible scenario or, like, things that could develop out of that? I mean, you can kind of just look at what's going on now and see, like, what are results of things like that that have happened before, and then what are the benefits of it? So it's true, like, we already kind of participate in those kinds of behaviors. So it's just about looking at how they would go down that avenue, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's one of the things you talk about in the book, the comparisons where this sort of argument is being played out, is really about writing and communication. And that was really interesting for me because we tend to think about post-human technologies as kind of power technologies. And this is like they enable you to do things and you can extend your range, extend your power. But particularly with this mind meld possibility, you know, you're really talking as much about another media as you are talking about a kind of technology of power or control. And then there's this whole discussion about communication, about writing, about, you know, writing is a disaster in many ways, you know? I mean, it's you can have a very, very negative view, which, you know, even Plato did, of, like, the effects of writing. Suddenly these secrets are no longer kept between carefully cultivated elites, but they're just lying around for anybody to stumble upon them, and there's all sorts of things that happen with information that's been able to be captured in writing. But who's going to stand up and say, yeah, we should have really not done the writing thing? You know, it's
absolutely.
And the reason I say that is not just because the way that we wouldn't have turned down a whole bunch of other technologies that have had mixed bags, like airplanes and penicillin or whatever. But for me, there's something specifically, there's a higher value in a lot of ways to communication. There's something intrinsic about who we are, maybe I would say spiritually, rather than just, you know, animals that are trying to survive, not that they're mutually exclusive, but there's something, there's a kind of a spiritual value in communication that I feel like is part of what makes your book really interesting, is that you're not just talking about transhuman technologies that are going to change everything and they're going to create new possibilities and new forms of destruction, et cetera, but you're actually reflecting on a kind of potential of the mind, of the soul, of culture that has this kind of spiritual character, even though it's also really dangerous. And it's a very interesting blend. I mean, how you have at one time, and I'd love to have you talk a little bit more about how even your thinking has changed on this, that on the one hand you clearly have owe something to a sort of a hippie idealism of the possibility of human beings being able, through whatever means, to really truly commune with each other, to have emotionally powerful forms of connection, of immediacy, of a kind of telepathic understanding that is really transformative and really positive, and that's a very strong value. And at the same time, that technology, in your fiction, is tied directly to what many of us would consider the most heinous thing imaginable, which is total coercion, where you're actually physically taken over and you can't even move your body and you're doing things and saying things you don't want to do because of the coercive aspects of that. So I would just love to hear you riff on how you feel about that potential.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really big question, and so I do agree with you about the spiritual aspect, and a part that I try to emphasize, something that I talk about a little bit in the book, is the idea of group mind, of meta-organisms, and that the idea that we've always been part of group minds, always been part of meta-organisms. That if you have an individual human, why did humans become the dominant species on this planet? It's not just because we're so smart as individuals. A very smart human is still no match for a saber-toothed tiger. But a group of very smart humans is a match for the entire population of saber-toothed tigers. And that's because we're able to share these ideas back and forth, to commune, to converse. And that, I mean, that's extending all of us. We're all, to a certain extent, growing from all of that, from all that contact with others. But at the same time, it's impossible to look at media and conclude that the majority of it is anything other than crap. There's some good stuff on the internet. There's some good stuff on television. There's huge amounts of good stuff, actually. But there's an awful lot of stuff that's not very uplifting or not very useful. It's not outright coercion, but it's definitely not something you'd look at and say, wow, I'm really glad that exists in the world. So that's kind of a paradox. It's the paradox of democracy, too. It's how is it that a bunch of people who are individually less smart, less educated, less specialist in all these topics than the elites, how is it that a government made up of those people ultimately is more enduring and does better than a government just run by the elites? In a certain way, it's the same paradox of capitalism. How is it that a market where individual consumers are really poor decision makers on average still does better than a state-controlled one? So all of these are cases where there's a lot of crap, there's a lot of bad decisions, a lot of less than uplifting uses of media or of modes of communication or of our own individual minds, but somehow we can come together into something bigger. So that's something I just see as kind of universal, and I wanted to portray Nexus as being like that as well.
That makes that makes a great deal of sense. I actually wanted to ask you specifically on the politics in a bit, but we're going to have to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Ramez. How do you pronounce your last name, Maz?
Nam.
Nam. Okay, I just want to make sure I got it right. I just know you as Maz.
Yep.
With Ramez Nam, and we'll be right back after this. Thanks.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. Thorne here with Eric Davis. We're speaking with Rama Snam about transhumanism. And, I'd be interested in getting into some of the political stuff and about how we act in groups, because that's just so crazy. And, you know, it's funny because that idea of the threat of mind control through this technology, there's obviously already a lot of sort of, dare I call them cults or conspiracy theories that kind of thing is already happening. Like if you look at the entire religion of Scientology, right? Everybody basically has these implants, and then there's certain people that have figured out how to get them out and then take control of ourselves back. And I always think, like, in all of those, even all the sci-fi books, right, there'll be, like, the government will have mind control over people, whether it's with chips or drugs, like in Brave New World. And then what happens is there'll be these small factions of, like, the hackers, basically, that are smarter, and then they'll figure out how to hack the mind control that the government's using. So that kind of thing has always been fascinating to me, that concept that, yeah, even if you have, like, kind of someone trying to control the hive mind, that within that there's the individual smarty pants that will then, like, figure something out, and then that consciousness spreads, you know, like 100th monkey style into everybody else's thing, and then we can kind of resolve it. I mean, was that sort of something that you explored in the book?
Yeah, I mean, a big debate in the book is the role of individual freedom versus top-down control, you know, bottoms-up versus top-down. And I definitely, you know, I take the side of bottoms-up in the book, but I also try to do the best job I can doing a good faith effort representing the motives behind people who want top-down control. And in particular, if we think about it in the political sense, you know, I have this as a world, and the world is a very clear parallel to the current war on drugs and the current war on terror. It's only 27 years in the future, which might sound like a lot, but that's the same as 1986 is as far back in the past as this book is in the future. So it's not that radically different. And so I posit
that's funny
that, hey,
because 1986 was the year that Eric Drexler's book came out.
Yeah, Engines of Creation. That was a great book. It was interesting to hear you talk about that.
Yeah.
So I try to say, hey, look, some bad things have happened. People have used biotechnology to create bioweapons that have killed thousands or tens of thousands of people. Terror attacks bigger than 9/11. People have used neurotechnology to create cults that are actually mind-controlled and abuse people. People have tried to use genetic engineering to create a new master race in at least one case, and so on. So the world is kind of understandably paranoid about this technology or these classes of technologies and views them as a big threat. And so that's why people are like, hey, let's not do this research. We have to make this sort of thing illegal because it's very, very dangerous if developed. And at the same time, I try to show how, you know, it's possible to overreact in the same way that the U.S. war on terror has been a massive overreaction to what actually happened in 9/11, not to mention the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan has been a massive overreaction to something that was bad but was not as bad as the things we've done in response to it. I think that's a natural human tendency, to overreact to things that are shocking in that way. So I portray the world in that way.
How likely do you think it is that there will be that degree of a kind of aggressive political legal battle, if you will, between sort of people who are holding on to a certain concept of humanity and these sort of post-human or transhuman possibilities?
I'm actually an optimist about how this will actually go down. I think there will be legal battles about it, but I don't think it'll be as strenuous a legal battle or political battle as I posit in the book. And the reason for that, I think, is that people are pretty self-interested. They're very accepting of things that actually give them benefits after they get over the weird factor. So every past biotechnology has looked weird from the beginning. in vitro fertilization, you know, it's not that long ago we called it test tube babies. Nobody says about IVF anymore. You just know that your friends had some sort of problem, and then they went to a doctor, and then they had kids. And kind of who cares? They got a normal, healthy kid out, right? I mean, that's how it is. But when IVF first came out, the cover of Time magazine was test tube babies, and there were huge reports done by ethics commissions and yada, 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 yada. It looked very alien, and it looked very scary. But the reality is that the actual base desire of couples to have kids overruled that, combined with the fact that it worked, that it produced normal babies, that it was not too ridiculously expensive. It's pretty expensive, but it's not millions of dollars. All of those things combined meant, okay, we'll get used to this. And you can go back as far as vaccination. When the first vaccines were created, the first smallpox vaccine was created by scraping cowpox sores off of cows and then putting that material in humans. And people thought that was ridiculous. It was horrifying. There were newspaper. Yeah, it is pretty gross. But there were newspaper editorial cartoons. This is in about, this is a while ago. There were newspaper cartoons that showed like a half man, half cow hybrid and depicted this as some sort of horrible dehumanizing biotechnology. The term didn't exist back then. That's basically what it was. And who thinks about that now? Blood transfusion.
Well, they actually made half man, half cow embryos. That's on the BBC if you look it up. It's kind of gnarly.
Yeah. We have done all kinds of stuff with chimeras and hybrids. So the norm is to freak out about new biotechnologies, anything that looks gross. We're kind of inherently biased to avoid things that involve lots of exchange of bodily fluids or waste products. All those things look like potential disease vectors to us. So our gross response kicks in. But then when they have value, what happens is that the early adopters try them out, and then the rest of us slowly see, oh, okay, that person did this and they seem okay, and they've got a healthy baby, or they were cured by that disease or whatever. And then people get more used to it.
It also says something about, you know, what it means to feel like you're still human, like in a normal quote unquote sense, meaning like, you know, well, we're still more or less like we were 2,000 years ago, or, you know, things have changed, but this comes up a lot because that's often the line that people are going to draw. It's like, at that point, we're no longer human, you know, and there's this like terror line where it's like something is really going to rupture, and whether or not we describe certain things as transhuman or certain things as posthuman, it's almost beside the point of what I'm suggesting here, which is that there's clearly something in human culture, in human subjectivity, in the way that we organize the world, where we can kind of adapt ourselves to pretty peculiar environments, but sort of find ourselves back into a somewhat familiar kind of human framework. And it's really one of the great gifts of science fiction, and it's not often kind of recognized, because it's like you can say, like, well, you know, a conservative idea about what humans are would be like, we're holding the line against all these encroaching post-human threats, and we're still holding true to the traditions and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the flip side is that no, actually you've just done an incredibly good job of, like, updating your, you know, human software thing in the midst of a situation that's totally science fiction and already utterly bizarre. I mean, electricity and telegraphy and genetic, it's crazy. You're way, way past that point. But somehow we as sort of a collective idea, kind of keep going in this recognizably human way. And when I think about the sort of issues about the transhuman and the posthuman, and I sometimes wonder about the value of those terms, not because I'm interested in defending some concept of humanity, which, as your book points out, is always a political thing, often a negative political thing, but more that we really don't know how far we can keep this game of more or less human, more or less familiar thing going, because the situation is already so bizarre. You know, we don't know. Does that make sense?
The situation is already bizarre. I think your point about the value of the words transhuman and so on is a good one, actually. I try to avoid them because my basic view is most humans are transhumanists, which means that most humans, you go to them and say, hey, I've got this thing. It'll make you remember better. It'll make you smarter. It'll slow down your aging. You'll look younger. You'll feel younger. It'll make you stronger. It'll make you think faster. And here's the price tag, and some of your buddies have done it, and it's been shown safe. You know, they'll say yes. They might not say yes on the first exposure, but humans like that kind of stuff. And when things can be portrayed as being non-human or over the edge when they're kind of conveniently not up in your face to a certain extent, when you're not forced to choose, when there's some sort of abstract idea. But when suddenly you're in a position where they could add value to you, your idea of where the human line is tends to change pretty rapidly, I think.
Yeah.
Well, whenever anything appeals to our desire nature, everyone's pretty much down, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's also another element too, which and I want to open this up, especially given the kinds of things we talk about on the show, where you weave Buddhism into your book in a very kind of interesting way. I mean, there's a lot that happens with these, these Thai Buddhist communities and leaders, and in some ways, Buddhism kind of offers a sort of third way between, on the one hand, the conservative hold on to humans at any cost, even if our soldiers actually have to become transhuman in order to defend humans, which is, of course, a crazy paradox. And on the other hand, you have these kinds of elite post-humans who are really like, look, the humans are going to hold us down, da da da. And then your book, in many ways, tries to find like a middle road. And some of that has to do with democracy and some of the things you mentioned before, that it's really important to continue to democratize and to some extent capitalize these things and bring them out into the market, bring them out into people's lives. But there's also a kind of, again, a sort of spiritual element where you see some things in Buddhism that can help us navigate some of the problems that you raise in the book, and I'd love to. That's not as often found in kind of transhuman discourse. So I'd love to have you riff a little bit about how important that stuff was for you and what it seemed to do in the novel, if not for in a larger view.
Well, it's super fun, and I find it fascinating. I'm not a Buddhist myself, but if I was to pick a religion, that's the one that I'd go with. And I've just found a couple of things about it are really fascinating. One is that there's such a huge emphasis in Buddhism on actually a practice of stilling the mind and investigating the mind. And it's almost like Buddhism is more like a mental exercise program to some people than it is a religion to a certain extent. Certainly meditation is you can think of it as a very spiritual thing. You can also think of it as a very grounded thing of exercising the mind. Or you can think of it as a scientific thing of exploring the mind. And so I think that's just a fascinating area. And I've been very interested to see how Buddhism, more than any other religion, has embraced a rich dialogue with science. So you have now conferences that happen where some of the top neuroscientists in the world get together with the Dalai Lama and some of his top monks and talk about the neuroscience of the brain versus what Buddhist monks know about the brain. And I happen to know two neuroscientists, two friends of mine, who have both worked with very senior meditators, very senior monks, and have met the Dalai Lama and heard him speak and so on. And the stories that they tell are really fascinating. I sort of relate one in the book, actually, where there's a scientific conference. It's a small event. There's about 40 scientists there. One of my friends happens to be in the room, and the Dalai Lama is speaking, and he's talking about how productive so far the work has been of these scientists studying the very experienced meditators has been. And one of the scientists asks him a question, and he says, you know, Your Holiness, in the course of this, as we take this project further, what if science shows that something is wrong with Buddhism, something about how you've been teaching what we should do with our minds and so on is incorrect? And the Dalai Lama says, well, then Buddhism would have to change. And that's amazing to me. That's something that's remarkable and unlike what you'd hear from basically any other religion. So
yeah.
I found that fascinating. And in the book, I have a senior monk kind of inverting the question on scientists and saying, hey, what if we show that something about neuroscience is wrong? Will you guys change? So that's one aspect. The other aspect is a key tradition and a key line of thought in Buddhism is about eliminating the illusion of distinction between other and self. The idea that really, this idea that we are just our bodies in this space is kind of drawing an arbitrary line between what we think of as part of us and what's not. You know, is the clothing that I'm wearing part of me? Is the phone that I'm using part of me? And are you and I together another entity that actually exists, that's not just our relationship? And in that, you know, communication technology to me seems like a key thing that would advance that line of thinking. And in particular, if you can actually connect minds from one person to another person, then it seems to me that you're closer towards that Buddhist goal of eliminating Maya, the illusion of distinction from person to person. So in the novel, a set of Buddhist monks have embraced Nexus very secretly and are experimenting with it for just this purpose. And because they have such excellent control over their own minds from their years or decades of meditation training, they have in some ways taken it further than the scientists who are coming at it from a very reductionist left-brain viewpoint have. And that those two lines of exploration are actually quite complementary and compatible. You can get the best of both worlds to some extent.
It's
just about access to the collective unconscious, right? There's that, like you said, there's that kind of sphere of places where everything becomes one thing and you can get out of yourself and then kind of join up with that. And it's funny, too, because that occurs on the biological level as well within our bodies. Like, I got really sick with pneumonia a couple weeks ago, and the pneumonia actually lives in your body, you know, from the moment you're born until the moment that you die. But then is it part of you? Is the pneumonia Maja, or am I Maja? Or, like, are the bacteria that live in your intestines, are those you, or are they not you? So then it's like, you know, you get all these technologies and drugs or things that go into you, and then, you know, where does the you stop and then the other begin? So then the question that's really interesting is that are these communication technologies that allow us to kind of break out of that and go into the meta? I mean, it's very fascinating to think if you would take a drug, is it just that it's happening within your own body, that like all those things that are the parts of you are actually coming together into a kind of singularity, you know?
Lots of big questions, yeah. And at the point on microbes, you have 10 times as many microbial cells in your body as you have cells of your body.
Mostly other stuff, totally.
Yeah.
Well, it's also interesting to me because I think one of the things, and I think you touch on this in some really nice ways in your book, but other people have also kind of pointed out the sort of looking ahead and looking at some of the problems that we're going to face, that we're already facing in terms of, you know, globalization and everyone being sort of integrated in this like crazy way, and there's a lot of reactionary movements and people trying to who are afraid and da 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 da. That there's something in Buddhism that seems like better, a better operating system for our current moment than other religious modalities for a lot of reasons. But one of them turns on this a kind of issue that's like floating in the air for me right now about some of the things you've been talking about. On the one hand, the way that you've talked about the introduction of transhuman technologies and your kind of optimism that they will be integrated into our, you know, global capitalist world has to do with people's self-interest. So it's going to make you smarter. It's going to make you work better. It's going to make you love more. It's going to give you more the pleasure. You're going to extend your life. All of these things are, and I'm not saying this in a negative way, but they're fairly selfish. They have to do with the idea that's, you know, of course, incredibly important to consumer capitalism, that you know, I as a self want to extend myself. I have my own desires that you can rely on me to be greedy in certain ways in order to kind of keep the system going. And that's a positive thing. Obviously, that's negative sides too. But the kind of collective consciousness, whether it's mind-to-mind collectivity or whether it's our increasing recognition that we are already incredibly embedded in all of these networks, whether they're microbial networks inside of our own bodies and guts, whether they're communication networks, whether they're genetic networks, and that this idea that I am a separate being that can go and satisfy my desires and extend my own life becomes kind of flimsy the more that I recognize that I am already part of these broader ecological networks, et cetera, et cetera. So there's kind of a weird tension, paradox, around precisely this question of do these things actually enhance our individuality, our selfishness, our ability to our desire to maximize my own ego and my own self, or in some sense are they driving us towards more integrated ways of seeing and being that just have to kind of challenge that fundamental driver?
That's a huge question, and I've got a couple of things to say about that, but I'm not sure that we can satisfy it today. But let me take a couple of thoughts. One is that I'm not sure that there is actually a conflict between empowering the individual and becoming more integrated with either each other or with nature or so on. Like, I would say that today, the average person lives in the most interconnected world ever, and yet the average person is also the most individually empowered ever, that our interconnection to some extent is a source of strength. Now, that doesn't answer the question about changing that perspective, because we can't act entirely selfishly in an unconstrained manner and actually have that kind of interconnected world that makes sense. So now we put rules around ourselves. You know, we build regulations of what you can and can't do, or even we have social etiquette and things like that that govern how we interact with each other. And some of those are baked into the way that we've evolved as social animals, and some of them are added on top of them. Will this sort of thing lead to increasing integration? Will it lead to increasing our set of goals so they're not just selfish? You know, I think maybe. And I think maybe specifically because of the power of communication technologies. I think that one of the things that has happened with the shrinking of the world due to telecommunications and media is that we've gotten more empathy for wider sets of groups. So look at the U.S. today, and it's hard to believe, but when you look at poll numbers on questions of how people feel about other races, other genders, other religions, other sexual orientations, all of them show kind of the highest levels of acceptance of others and tolerance and empathy ever recorded in the U.S. And I think a lot of that is because we get exposed to those other people. We're a tribal species. When we evolved, you were surrounded by 50, 60, maybe 100 other people who were basically all your relatives, who all looked like you. Anyone else in either tribe was more likely to be a threat than anything else. So you feared the other. It is baked into our brains to fear the other and the unknown. So if you're a white person and you see a black person, it's the first person you've ever seen, you have some biological wiring to fear someone that looks different than you. But if you've grown up even watching, I don't know, the Cosby Show, suddenly you've been enculturated in a way, and you no longer think of this as necessarily an other sort of experience. This person has become part of your tribe because you're exposed to them. And I think in a simple way, and I don't have the data to back this up, but in a similar way, watching nature shows, seeing shows about people in foreign countries, interacting with people who are from foreign countries at work or online or socially, I think all of those can build up our empathy and broaden our sense of who is part of the in crowd, who is part of the collective us. So that, and that kind of gets back to the Buddhist and spiritual things too. There's a character in the book who very much believes that, hey, by releasing Nexus to as many people as possible, we can increase global empathy and actually, you know, decrease global war. Is his personal pitch, and he might be sort of naive and idealistic about this, but in a certain sense, I think that's happening today. And if we could go further than just seeing images of other people, but actually touch their minds and know how they felt and thought about things, I think that would be a powerful tool for changing our motivations and changing our values so that we actually did care about others in the world.
All right. Well, that's a wonderful place to end, where we got to wrap it up now. Mez, thanks so much for being on the show, and congratulations on Nexus.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Eric. Thanks, Maja.
Thanks, man.
Okay, and I do recommend people check out the book. It's widely available. And from Maja and me and all of us here at PERN, keep your minds open.